Welcome to the True Podcast. I'm joined today by David Thorpe and Seth Partner. How are you guys?
Who are you?
Oh, I'm Henry Abbott. Okay, so here's the deal. David and I have been friends for 750 years, and in that amount of time, we generally agree. We get along fine. Was that fair to say, David?
More than fair.
Here and there, a little disagreement, including a pretty good one. And I'm just going to set up the story here a little bit. Okay, so, and Seth is here. We'll talk to you more in a second, Seth, to referee this this little disagreement we had. Okay. Seth, you don't know him. He's the director of basketball research. He was the director of basketball research for the Bucks. He's the author of The Mid-Range Theory and is an analyst of basketball at The Athletic. Hi, Seth.
Hello.
Okay. So on October 27th, which feels so long ago now, before the election, a lot of things have happened. This game ended in a way that really got me thinking. Luka and the Mavericks were visiting the Nets. Luka was amazing. He was totally dominating. But somehow the Nets roared back in the fourth quarter, and with 12 seconds left, Ben Simmons stole the ball from Luka, raced the length of the court, and then he had this little moment that reminded me a little bit of why they hate him in Philly, which is he kind of like didn't want to attack the rim, and he turned his body away from the rim around the free throw line, and Kevin Durant was flying a million miles an hour, and he just passed it to Durant, and Durant dunked it with 8 seconds left to tie the game. Tie game, 8 seconds, and I just had this feeling right then that the Nets might have screwed that up. I shared this thought with David. And David, do you remember what you said then?
First of all, I want to make sure I heard it clearly. And I said, so you're saying that Durant should not have had taken the absolute wide open dunk to tie the game and elected to dribble back behind three or stop at three to begin with and try to win or lose the game. And you said, yes, that's what I'm contending.
So we agree you were a little disrespectful.
Probably. With you, I sometimes show my real personality, which is a little bit disdainful. I'm pretty much skeptical of everything in this world. I tend to hide it pretty good. Mm-hmm. And yes, I don't think I called you any names, but I thought you were batshit crazy.
So then, yeah. Before we bring in our referee, I will explain what I was thinking a little bit.
You made a great argument. Absolutely.
So you said, David, that we actually agreed that we thought maybe the Nets were about so what the Nets could have done down two was like hold for the last shot, shoot a 3 meter to win the game. And I'm going to guess that the number was 30% that Durant or likely Durant would score in that situation. So I was like, okay, 30%. I agree. Meanwhile, I'm feeling like it's 50% that the Mavs would score any points with their last 8 seconds, right? Plus another 50% that the Mavs would win in overtime. Probably more than 50%. So that's half of half, right? 25% likely the Nets win if they score right then. 30%
to tie the game, right.
And but I'm making up these numbers. You're making up these numbers. We have Seth's actually looked into this with actual data, which is extremely helpful. So later that day, I called Seth, and Seth, what did you tell me?
I said, yeah, you were wrong, but it's actually closer than one might think.
Sure.
Kind of because of what you're talking about. Just the generally speaking, I'm a big fan of down two going for three. Because overtime still means you lose half the time. This is an interesting situation as well, because you're also, as you say, leaving time on the clock. So you could lose in regulation, which is why a bit, not to bounce off of your topic and go to one of my favorites, but it's kind of why sort of the last possession tie game scenario always looks kind of ugly, but it should, because the most important thing really is the ball in the air when the clock expires. Because again, taking losing in regulation off the table. So just the fact that it's a dunk, that's a 95%+ shot, makes it too much to overcome for a three-pointer, which as you surmise is probably in that situation in the low 30s. I think you also slightly overestimated the likelihood of the Mavs winning in regulation, just because over basically as long as we have reliable play-by-play data, that sort of shot clock off tie game or shot clock off shot to tie or win has been a slightly above a 30% shot for everybody.
That's the number. That's a big difference. We suck at that apparently in the NBA. It turns out
if you think about it, the advantage the offense has is the other team doesn't know who, when, and where the shot's going up. In a last second situation, you've got a pretty good idea of when and a very good idea for most teams of who. And that sort of, and the where kind of gets defined by the other two. It's probably going to be somewhere at the top of the floor. So all of the kind of surprise advantages the offense has kind of goes away, go away a little bit.
So David was right.
Well, in your defense, I mean, I understood your argument very well. And I think Seth put it really clear that the Durant dunk was such a big deal. It was just, you know, you're not, and he was going full speed. So I would have said 99% and a chance for a foul. Like he was trucking. I remember the play very vividly, as I know you do, Henry, because we talked about it so much. But to something Seth said about going for three versus two, this is where, like, I've spent much of my young life as a coach at coaching clinics. And as great as the coach, I mean, I saw Dean Smith and, I mean, you could, PJ Carlesma, all these great, great clinicians. But the best thing was after hours, Seth. I don't know if you ever went to a coaching clinic where you're with a lot of other coaches. I didn't drink alcohol back then, so I would just eat and have iced tea, and we would talk till 2 in the morning about X's and O's. And what we heard, what we've gone through ourselves, whatever. And
think how smart you'd be if you never started drinking.
Yeah, I blame the kids for that. That's the twins' fault. Yeah, I have no problem doing that. So Seth, what we would talk about in that situation, what I've always believed, and this is where coaches differ, is I always want to hunt the best shot possible. So I'll take a two if it's a dunk. If it's my best player, I call it the second box, open, I'll take that. But if he kicks it out for three and it's my job to make sure I've got good shooters on the court, I'm fine with that too. I'm okay with a two or three. I want the best shot possible if the two ties and three wins. The danger we get into sometimes is if you start giving players a forceful edict, they'll scramble and end up with something pretty bad, you know? And that goes into the other part of this discussion, Henry and Seth, that I think is really fascinating, which is the messaging. And Seth, I want you to chime in on this because you do your job. And our job as coaches is, in my opinion, greatly value what you have to say on the pure data numbers part of it. I happen to believe in that very much. I know that you know some coaches don't. I do. And I think I'm right to trust you smart guys and girls. But we also have to message our players. So there won't be a lot of players, and I said this to you, Henry, in that conversation, who would be fired up to say, oh, we're not going to trust our defense here. We're going to turn down a Kevin Durant wide open dunk. And Henry very smartly responded by saying, well, your job is to sell it better. And I agree with you, Henry. If indeed the math was right, that is your job. But this is a big part of that, is getting guys to, if you're going to buy into defense every single day, that's your only shot to be, in my opinion, a quality defense. And so part of this sales pitch is that. And then last thing on this, because Seth mentioned it too, when you talk about two versus three and you eliminate the reason why you take the shot and the ball in the air, is to eliminate losing as an option. We're going to be tied or we're going to go overtime. We're not going to lose because they're not going to touch the ball. And you may remember this, Seth, from Kareem's book, Giant Steps, where he tells the story when they're, you know, he's got that long unbeaten streak. They're playing against USC on the road, last game of the regular season. You know, Kareem might be a junior. I don't remember what year it was. And they're up two, and John Wooden tells his team to foul intentionally late in, like, in the last few seconds of the game. And, you know, these players are going to do whatever John Wooden says. But after, John Wooden doesn't tell them why. He just says, foul them. We'll win in overtime if they make both. They do. USC makes both free throws. UCLA rolls in overtime. Afterwards, Coach Wooden says, the only way we're losing this game is if they get an and one on a putback on the road. They get a tip in. The refs, they may call it. We're eliminating that chance. There's no way they're getting the offensive rebound on a second shot miss because we got Kareem in the game and whoever else they had. And it doesn't mean John Wooden was right to do that, but I thought it was interesting. It's the same idea. We're not going to lose on some emotional referee blowing a whistle on a tip-in against this team that we think will kick their ass in overtime. So all those factors, to me, come into stuff beyond just the math. We lost Seth. God, right when I was pitching to him.
Like yeah, literally. No, you were really, you're like building up Seth there, and then he just went away.
David, this was like, you were really setting the table here. But what I'll say is, while Seth hopefully comes back in, and I hope we don't have to re-record this, but we might have to because it's going to be at a weird moment. as you guys know, I'm all for the data. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes we go too far down the rabbit hole and there's still the human piece of it. Like David's saying, you have to sell it. Like guys have to believe like, all right, this is going to be a thing. And yes, that comes down to coaching and how many, I mean, David, you say it every week on the show.
Yeah.
Teams are bad. They don't cut, right? Coaches don't do that. So how am I going to all of a sudden do this thing?
Yeah.
Look, all Seth's right. here.
We're pitching to you, Seth.
Wait, are we okay? Gerard, do you think we're okay to pick it up here?
We should be okay to pick it up here.
Okay. All right, Seth.
So there's a lot to unpack there. First of all, it's interesting you brought up the fouling up, too. That's something that's kind of coming back a little bit.
Yeah.
I know there's been stories of Todd Golden.
Todd Golden's assistant, who I've mentored for a decade, Jonathan Sapphire, it was his idea. Very smart guy. Yeah, Florida. Yeah, for Todd.
So there's something Henry said that I agree with.
Yay!
I put a slight twist on. And something you said, Coach, that I want to disagree with.
Come on, let's go.
Get double yay.
Let's go.
Yeah.
So starting with Henry first.
Sorry, Seth. We're adults, I promise. We're totally adults. We actually have our own podcast. That's how adult we are. Yeah. Okay. Anyway,
that's a high bar to clear. So Henry, you said, you know, it's coach's job to message it. That's part of it, but it's also almost taking the decision away from the players and just putting them in the situations where their basketball inclinations lead them to do the thing that is analytically indicated. Mm-hmm. Now, in a situation like, you know, guy coming down on a breakaway, maybe there's something else that might be a better, but there's you're not overcoming, you know, 20 some years of basketball training with anything that you know, any messaging. So that's just when you got to let that go. But if it's a situation where you kind of have a, you know, you're putting in a scheme, you're running a play, you're doing whatever, like those are situations where if you design it well, the right thing will happen because the players will get the ball in the situation where, okay, well, we want a three here. So we got Kevin Durant the ball on the wing behind the arc because that's how the play was designed. The thing I want to disagree with is you talked about getting the best shot.
Yeah.
And this is a key point at the end of the game. Usually for most of the game, really what you're trying to do is maximize how much you score on a given possession.
Of course.
You're trying to maximize the point differential that's created every time you have every time you kind of trade the ball off
that's
between
right.
you and the opposition. End of game, that changes slightly because really what you're doing all the whole game is trying to maximize your chances of winning the game. And for the first 46 and a half minutes of an NBA game, there's basically no difference between what is maximizing the points per possession here and what is maximizing your win probability. That changes a lot at the end of the game when the difference between being tied or being up two, being up three, being up one, being up two, those are big swings in probability. And so those are situations where just, you know, you're trying to maximize your ability to get to a profitable game state almost, rather than necessarily caring. I mean, the best example obviously is, you know, a tie game. A three might be higher points per possession, but you don't care about whether you win by two or three. You just care if you win. So like in that situation, you're going for literally the highest percentage shot, not the highest effective shot, percentage shot. Mm-hmm. So I think that while your intuition is largely correct, this specific set of circumstances we're talking about does sort of change the goals. Just that little bit slightly. That make the decision a little bit different than it would be for 46 and a half minutes.
So we don't disagree.
To say it back to you a different way, David was totally wrong and I was right.
No. Seth, we completely agree. No, you're not disagreeing with me at all. So as an example, I'd rather have Durant take a contested 14-footer than almost anyone else on my team taking an open shot. Because not only does Durant, I think, have a very good chance to make the shot because it's almost impossible to contest it, he also has a chance to get fouled, and he's Kevin Durant. And so if you sneeze on him or wink at him, they might call it. Whereas the second or third year player is open from 17 feet, is not going to get anything. He's just wide open. He makes or misses. That's it. That's all part of the math I'm talking about. The best shot is when it's a tie game or we're down one or even down two just to score. That's all I'm saying. I always tell my players, we run a monarchy here, not a democracy. So you want to be the king, be able to score against anybody. Right. So I'm a big believer in that part of the best shot philosophy, too. My only point is, if you say I'm going for a three, but I'm giving up twos to allow you to tie the game, and I'm doing a great job of guarding that three, I think if you tell your team we got to get a three to win the game, there's no guarantee you're going to get a good shot on that. I think they're better off just taking the two. You know,
no, and again, I think that's a spot where you design the play where the first couple options are for three, but
sure.
Like the counter right. Is like, okay, if you know, I don't think Brad Stevens is really the only NBA coach I've seen really do this consistently, which is in an opponent needs a three situation, just kind of have all five defenders play on the outside rather than the inside of
yeah. So kind of top locking those guys
and forcing
them to go towards the rim. Yeah.
And if you go to the basket and you get a shoot a layup, fine.
Yeah.
But in a situation where you can get like a slip to the basket or something like that, have that be part of the play. But if you're going to go for a two, make it a legit, like, you know,
right.
70, 80, 90% shot. Not a lot of the times that anyone who's sort of followed along with me before knows how much I love the, as I call it, the quack two. Like so much. So like, we're down four. We don't need a three here.
Right.
And so the 2-point shot is often neither quick nor a two because it's a tough shot that takes 10 seconds to develop.
Mid-range theory, you have this thing called end of game nonsense. This is what you're talking about, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think that we tend to overvalue. Oh yeah, sure. We can get a layup here, and yeah, maybe you can. But if you can get a layup here, why aren't you running the play to get that same layup the whole time? So you're not like down late in the game. You know, why are you saving it?
Right, but that brings up. So the best play you'll see end of game situations, and I have a former assistant who sends me every single day, 7 days a week, the best ATOs from the night before, 5 minutes of tape pretty much every single day on my cell phone. I don't watch all 5 minutes every single day. I can tell you that. I used to want to do that. I don't do that. I'm not in that business anymore. But the best thing, the best play you can see when a team is up three, and the other team has the ball late in the game, and I'm just making sure they don't get a three, run a dribble handoff at the 3-point line to your best driver, and have your best shooter come off for the handoff. They're gonna go. Everyone's gonna go to that shooter. And you're going to fake the handoff, what Zach Lowe calls it, a quarterback keeper.
Keeper, yeah.
And you'll dunk, and they score in 1 second all the time. Pop's the first guy that used to always do that, and they score in 1 second all the time. But whereas over the course of a game, you're not going to defend it that way, right? Doesn't mean you won't be effective. You're not wrong, Seth. You should be running your best actions more. This is part of the problem I think we have sometimes in our league is we tend to get away from our best actions. For all the reasons that we've always talked about, selfishness, money deals, contract, all those things are in play. There's a lot of actions that are really hard to guard that teams don't run nearly enough. And to finish that thought, when I help G League point guard Seth, I literally tell him this, you'll laugh. I'll say, when in doubt, just call for a ball screen because no one in that league knows how to defend it. So if you can cook your guy, some of these guys are so talented with the ball, great. Don't waste time trying to cook a guard. Get the switch that you want if a team is switching. If they're not switching, always go to ball screen action because no one in that league has a clue how to defend it. And yet you watch G League, which unfortunately, as my cohorts here were enjoying World Cup action, I'm watching G League tape and everything. I have to pay attention to all this stuff. These guys aren't using these best actions that are so hard to guard any level, much less a level where a bunch of 21-year-olds are playing. I have no clue how to defend ball screens.
This episode of True Hoop is brought to you by BetterHelp. Hey guys, Terod from True Hoop here. If you had an extra hour in your day, what would you do? It's a hell of a question. Would you maybe go for a run, take a nap, read a book, or maybe show up for a friend? Now, depending on the day, any one of those would be a great idea. Most of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but the question is, time for what? If time was unlimited, how would you use it? The best way to squeeze that special thing into your schedule is to know what's important to you and make it a priority. Therapy can help you find what matters to you so you can do more of it. Now, I've been open in the past with you guys about this. I see a personal therapist as well as a couples therapist for my partner and I. and both are extremely helpful in developing positive coping skills and learning how to set boundaries. Therapy empowers you to be the best version of yourself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/truehoop today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/truehoop.
Seth, do you have any view on ball screens in the G League?
No, I have no strong thoughts about it. Other than I just remember, Henry, do you remember when we did you and I and Dave Dufour and Amina Hassan did a podcast at Sloan right before in 2020, right before the pandemic, and he was
recording in a random hallway. I kind of like
Recording in a random hallway, and he was sort of too. Can we swear on this pod?
Or, yes,
you can.
I'm gonna paraphrase what it was when Amin was with the Suns and Nick Nurse was the G League coach, and like they were teaching defense, and
I already know where you're going with this.
Yeah, it was always having a help come off the strong side corner, and like what are we doing? You don't help off the strong side corner, that motherfucker's never passing the ball.
Right, that's right. Yeah, basically, just to paraphrase again. The rule still exists. You don't easily leave a corner shooter to help a driver because that corner shooter typically is going to be a very good player in the NBA. But you can in the G League because that guy driving does not want to pass the ball to the corner shooter. It could be Seth Curry. 20% chance he's going to get the pass to the corner. And on that thought, I talked to a point guard today who thought he might spend some time in the G League this year, maybe a lot of time. And so far, no. He's playing a lot for his NBA team. And he watched a former teammate of his, I guess, or maybe just a friend in the G League the other night. He was like, oh, my God, is that hard to watch? I'm like, dude, I have to watch it all the time. What are you telling me for? He said, oh, my, they just don't play the right way at all. I said, I know. And they're not getting coached to because those coaches are so afraid to get in trouble. If you really empower your G League coach, you'll get a much better product from these young guys. Those kids want to be coached.
If this is not the topic of this podcast.
Oh, sorry. No, there's a question I want to ask you.
Yeah.
Because the hard part about the G League as a developmental league is a lot of what you're saying. Some of it's the structure. I mean, the fact that there's only, you only have the two-way guys and you don't really have any, you have
connection to the team. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
But is the player pool different enough that you can actually, first of all, you can't really replicate because I think there's just not enough quality bigs for it to play like NBA style basketball. And second of all, like guys in the G League aren't actually, when they're in a G League setting, they're not actually playing a role as they would play in the NBA. Cause if they're good enough to be an NBA role player, like
they'd be doing it.
Yeah. Well, also if they're good enough to be an NBA role player, they get enough to score 35 shots in the G League.
Exactly. Yeah, right. No, it's a great point. I watched the Santa Cruz Warriors play the other day to see James Wiseman. And they have, you'll see like the vestigial remains of the we call it the Cuisinart. It's you can see some glimpses of all players getting into the pinch post and running their split cuts. It's pretty rare. Development is, Gerard and I talk about this all the time in the NBA. I don't think we're at the, I think our league is the most talented it's ever been in the history of basketball. I don't feel that way about coaches, Seth. I don't think we have, and they might be able, I don't see them being as willing to coach as they have been in years past for lots of different reasons that I don't think it would be surprising to anyone. And we need to get back to that. That's on management. That's on ownership to empower the coaches to coach. And I think when that happens, you see much more connected teams. Udoka last year making, going with Horford and Robert Williams and having Robert Williams play center field. There are some coaches that would be afraid to make that move, especially as rookie coaches. And it clearly paid off very well for them. We need more of that. You got to empower these guys. And if they can't do it, find someone else, but you got to give them a chance to coach.
Seth, do you think you actually have in your book, there's quite a lot of analysis of like up against the clock moments. Do you feel like NBA coaches are screwing that up frequently, or do you feel like they generally get it right?
I think it's hard, and I think there's a lesson from football. in that, you know, why the coaches have the, you know, the laminated cards that have 7,000 plays. It's because they've studied all week to figure out, all right, their tendency in this situation is to do this. So we're going to counter that tendency by our best play is this other thing. Now, in the moment, you've got 10 seconds to make that decision. You can't recall the 250 plays in your playbook. It's like, no, you wrote it down that, you know, I've already decided that in this situation I'm doing this. And I don't think that enough of that happens in basketball. I think, you know, teams may practice special situation, but I'm not sure that there's sort of the, you know, we're on the bus on a baseball trip and everyone's sitting around and, all right, what do you do? It's a one out, first and third, down one, seventh inning, closer's not available tonight. Do you send the runner on a short fly ball to, you know, and all these kind of situational
scenarios,
things?
Yeah.
I, my sense is that we don't like get the mental flashcards of making those decisions with all the permutations of time, score, fouls to give, timeouts left, to be able to understand, okay, no, this is a spot where we need a three. This is a spot we need to foul. This is a spot where our whole playbook is open. And so these situations come up, and then you're trying to calculate all these things in the moment, and it's too much information to parse. And so you just kind of revert to some sort of baseline type. And quite often, I think that those are, you know, suboptimal options.
And I know Dave's going to have interesting thoughts here, but like I'll tell you that I would posit that in our mix of suboptimal options, that there's an under exploration of things that if they go badly, the coach gets blamed. So by that, I mean, if the Nets are down two and hold for the final shot and miss it, like everybody's talking about Steve Nash the next day, right? It's his fucking
fault,
right? Yeah. It was October 27th. Whole different world.
That's his proof.
Yeah. Whereas if you, and then this is, you know, this came up a lot. I wrote this story years ago about Hero Ball, right? Basically but several coaches kind of said to me on the download, like, look, if you give the ball to the guy who makes $27 million a year and he misses, no one talks about you. But if he passes to Derek Fisher, to pick a random person and he misses, right, Everyone talks about you. So like, there's just kind of like a job preservation component to the decision set. Fair.
Yeah. Yeah, Seth's nodding his head. It's a podcast, no. Seth.
No, yeah. It's a visual
video anymore.
No, I think this is, I mean, this is something that comes up a lot, like across sports, sort of. Just, you know, you don't stink out if you just abide by the conventional wisdom.
Right.
Even if the conventional wisdom is demonstrably
inferior.
I don't want to say, inferior. I think wrong is the wrong word. Inferior is the better way to put it.
Right, because it's not always black and white. All right, so let me dive in on this too, but I want to first say something about Seth. I don't mean this to make you blush, but so Henry and I are very lucky enough to have lots of conversations about these kinds of topics. We talk, you know, 5-6 days a week, many hours over the course of each week. And Seth, on this particular topic of the Durant play and many others, there's a limit to my knowledge off the court. It's vast. There's not much knowledge off the court. And so Henry just said that we should probably talk to, let's just talk to Seth. We should just call Seth. And I'm like, oh yeah, it's exactly what we should do.
It's like when you sign that document saying you'll go to mediation or whatever. It's like, we'll go to the mediator. It's fine. Yeah, we'll be fine.
That's my point. Yeah. But my point is,
you raise my rates.
Yeah, you do.
Right. Well, my point is, we have a lot of names we could list right there, Seth. We know a lot of people. And when he said your name, I'm like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. So we greatly value your judgment. Now that I've led with that, I'm not pulling it. No. I'm not going to play dirty pool this way. No. I'm gonna ask you a question. When one time me and Henry were talking, and we're like, we should just call Seth, but we were busy. We couldn't do it. So there was a time this year, recently, Henry, but last couple of weeks, where the Blazers we're up like two or three late in the game, but not like last second, like last 30 seconds or so, where Damian Lillard stayed in the game and they were on defense. Mm-hmm. And so when he said, like, you know, Henry very casually just asked, like, what would the thinking there be, being that he's a bad defender? And I said, well, I can only guess it's because he's a money free throw shooter. They're going to foul the rebounder. And if he can make a quick outlet to Damian, they'll foul Damian, which is great. So we said we should probably talk to Seth. So Seth, what are your thoughts on leaving a very, I'm not calling out Damian Lillard. Just X, Y, Z, leave a terrible defender in the game because he's a brilliant and clutch late game free throw shooter. What are your thoughts on that?
It's funny because I think I was probably watching the same game and I bumped on the same thing, except it wasn't Lillard. I was like, why is Anthony Simons still in the game?
He's gotten a little better though. I think he's a little better.
But I think, you know, I think that.
So what do you do on that?
I think this is one of the things that, so remember when Lob City Clippers and teams would start to play Hack a DeAndre.
Yep.
And there'd be these long stretches where every possession DeAndre Jordan's just going to the free throw line. And for some reason, Jamal Crawford's in the game. Hmm. And it just used to drive me nuts because you're not playing offense. You're only playing defense here. Right. And so I think that's one that's maybe a little more defensible in that, especially if you've kind of closed with the same group, bringing a guy cold off the bench, I can kind of see why that can be, you might not want to do that, but situationally, I think that I would like to see coaches more consistently. Now, Lillard is a special case because I think you're right that there's the, well, I got to get the ball and get fouled and do that thing. But the second bad defensive guard, surely you can. And if I remember the game correctly, actually, this was a game that Lillard hit a game winner, wasn't it? And Simons got hit with a pin in screen and the opposition, I forget who they were playing, got like a wide open corner three and drained it. And then they needed Lillard to hit the game winner to actually win it. And then like, got away with it kind of, but it's like this thing that you were worried about happening, like, you know, this very small guard got plastered on the screen, you gave up the one shot that can beat you.
There's a lot of games where Simons has been caught on a pin in the screen, and it's not just because he's slight. There's that's all footwork, as you know. Try screening Corey Brewer, and he weighs 125 pounds. But he was
very slippery.
So you couldn't screen him. I actually talked to Corey today about that. He is, it was a pride thing. Like, it was all about footwork and timing. And it's amazing. These offensive players, Seth, are so damn smart, where when you're chasing with pace around a screen, they just stop. And it's very, very hard not to hit them. So it's, I have to teach these players, I have to help guys defend those kinds of actions against Curry and Luka and all these great shooters or scorers. And it's all about angles. You have to make sure that if they stop, it's just like a car. You know, sometimes you're driving, you lose track just a little bit, and the car in front of you starts to kind of stop short, and you kind of have to pull to the side a little bit because you're not sure your brakes will really work. But that's what you got to do when someone like that is, you're chasing, you got to kind of angle to the side, because if you hit them, they're definitely calling a foul. It's hard to do. Which goes back to something Henry and I talk about all the time, and what you alluded to earlier, Seth. That's why I wish we'd run more actions at the end of games, and not just play hero ball. The problem, Henry, I already know the answer. They don't practice it enough. They practice it in training camp. Whereas in high school, you end every practice with, you know, five situations. That's how you should end every single practice in high school and college, pretty much, is situation, 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 situation. They don't do that in the NBA because they don't practice that way. Their games are practice in a sense. But I wish they would do that because these actions are hard to guard. And instead, they make it simple with, here's our best player dribbling for 11 seconds. And he's great, but I don't think we get great results out of that. Go ahead, Seth.
So I think I would put a little twist on it. I think that maybe we, like, there's too much focus on, all right, we're down three, we got a blah, blah, blah. It's just like, okay, we need a three, we need a two, we need to foul the shooter. We need just these broad concepts. And then you can apply whichever one matters the most in the given situation. And that's sort of what I mean by, was talking earlier about not getting the mental reps of making the decision which of those to call on.
Yeah.
Because that's the other part of, and that's from a coaching standpoint, knowing which of those to call on in a given situation. Yeah. And so that's a way that you can actually, the other reason why I don't think those, that gets done enough is that's those kind of special situations, those set pieces, as people would say,
set
in soccer,
pieces, right.
are time inefficient in limited practice time. And you, if you generalize them a little more, then they become more time efficient and probably worth spending time on.
Yeah,
that sounds smart.
So, yeah. on this topic, this is a favorite topic of mine, because the very end of game, that's maybe a slightly different situation, because again, you're playing the clock almost as much as you are the offense. Why do teams? I've been doing some research on clutch play just for my own edification, and by some measure, like last year's Celtics team was the worst clutch team of the last decade.
Wow.
And some of that is just bad luck,
right?
But if your offense starting with 6 minutes on the clock and you're up turns into I'm going to hold the ball up at the top of the floor until there's 10 on the shot clock every time, of course your offense is going to why?
Well, tell me why. We talked about this with Team USA Soccer. You know, Gerard would understand it better than me, but I guess we scored one goal and our back line backed off instead of staying up, which is riskier, but you're also a better chance to score a second goal and kind of end the game. I'm on your side, Seth. I think it's a mistake to change anything until my rule is always 2 minutes or less. Don't think about the clock until 2 minutes to go. But we deal with this all the time.
Like this you're talking about their dribble out the first half of the possession, though, right?
Yeah. I would never do that until 2 minutes to go, and then I start thinking about the clock.
David and I started talking about this a ton when LeBron was still in Cleveland the first time. And it was like, what is he doing with 14 seconds? Like, why is he just looking at everybody standing still? And like, you know, and the answer is that he's doing some chess, right? Like he's moving this guy. But it's, you give up a lot for that chess, right?
Like prime LeBron can do that.
Prime LeBron can do that.
And nobody else.
Like, and as good as Jason Tatum has become, I think we saw in the finals last year that he's not prime LeBron. And that's not like, ooh, we're hating on Jason Tatum. No, it's like, okay, he is not one of the two or three best players to ever play the game.
Was what Marcus Smart was mad about midseason, right? He was like, we're not a hero ball team, right? Like, what the hell? Like, we can't just do it. And, you know, so actually David's been on the warpath this season that basically, like, scheme is coming, right? Like,
tactics are coming,
right? Like, in Europe, they can't get easy buckets with just skill. And here we can, but I think, you know, the Warriors are sort of the case study in like, well, if you have a superstar who can do it all and you use tactics, so much the better, right? And so now you got to be better than that, right? So,
you brought up watching James Wiseman earlier.
Yeah.
And I think James Wiseman could not have gone to a worse team for him.
For sure.
Because you say the thing with the Warriors is there's not actually that many players who can play for the Warriors because they probably play on both ends of the court about the highest volume of decisions per whatever time period of any team in the league.
Oh, I'd rank them number one for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
More reads than anyone per possession.
Yeah. And so there's a limited set of players that I think can perform. Some good players have gone there and just not been able to, like Kelly Oubre basically couldn't function there.
Right.
Kelly Oubre, you define a role for him, can be a decent NBA player.
Super athletic. Yeah.
James Wiseman, you use him like Clint Capella. I bet we'd think a lot different of him if he went to a traditional pick and roll dive dunk situation.
I just said this the other on the air, and I think I even tweeted it. I don't remember if I tweeted or not, but, he should be Brook Lopez. He actually can shoot. He should be Brook Lopez. I mean, he can't be Brook Lopez. Brook Lopez is a 35-year-old veteran. But drop coverage, be a beast around the rim, and don't post him up a bunch. Don't run split cuts with him. He can't read the game. Like a lot of guys can't read the game. And then you could always – he wants to be Joel Embiid. But that's got to take – that's a long time from now. James, you haven't played in 3 years.
You should limit the menu of
– keep it very – I wrote an article about it 2 years – right before he got hurt last year. Keep it simple and let him get a foundation of success. But it's now, Seth, in the G League, he ain't passing that ball unless 8 guys are on him.
Well, and this happened with DeAndre Ayton, right? Like he had a very complicated set of opportunities and they just limited the list and he got much better.
He got much better as soon as they made it simple. That's exactly right.
I mean, I'm still reeling from the comparison of James Wiseman to Brook Lopez, who like the genius of Brook Lopez is his ability to read the game and you know guard two at once. And Eric Name at the Athletic wrote a great article about Brook Lopez again today. And I think,
I have to see that. I need to see that.
Yeah. I mean, I've been banging the drum about, you know, how good Brook Lopez has been defensively
unbelievable for
4 years.
But Seth, he's the guy that, he's my model when I work with young bigs on drop coverage. It's all Brook Lopez all the time. You can teach that. I've done it. And players have gone from being horrendous in drop coverage to stupendous, or at least very good, because it's just what you're saying. They're not all huge like Brook Lopez. James Wiseman actually is. I talked to one of his teammates recently. He's an enormous man. It's going to take a lot of time, but there's a better chance he learns to be Brook Lopez on both ends. Light. I'm not saying he'll be Brook Lopez again. Brook's 37, 35 years old, whatever. But there's a better chance to do that before he's Joel Embiid.
Or Draymond Green.
I was just going to say that. Yeah. He ain't making those reads. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just the distance he's got to go to be the Kevon Looney is.
Right. Well, that's, I was going to say, Kevon, to your point. People who know Kevon, I don't think he's a genius, like a basketball genius. He's from Milwaukee. Yeah. KD in Milwaukee. And so, yeah, no surprise that he fits so good. In fact, I just saw today, I think that's the number one points per pick and roll duo in the league is Curry and Looney. And Looney doesn't have many of those points.
No, he's so important to them. He is, like, I think that this is part of why I was very intrigued by the matchup with the Suns that never really came to be last year, is one of the big places where Phoenix may have had an advantage was if Ayton, you know, when Ayton decides to play with force, if he could have gotten Looney into foul trouble,
yeah,
that would have compromised the Warriors on both ends of the floor. But we never really got a chance to see. They played three times right around Christmas, and one of the games, that's what happened, and that was the game Phoenix won.
Yeah.
We didn't get a chance to see that in the playoffs. But
interesting.
Do you think, Seth, that doesn't happen enough? When I was a young coach, that was part of our strategy all the time. If we felt there was an opportunity to get into someone's depth, they just didn't have two or three. If they have two or three really good players, getting one guy in foul trouble, you're probably going to waste your time. But if there's just one dominant guy, we've got to have a strategy. We used to talk about get one offensive rebound foul on him. Let's get one illegal screen call on him. And let's get one charge call in the first half. We get those three things, we got a chance. Like, that's what we always would talk about. So I don't see that in the NBA nearly as much. It happens, but it's almost like an accident. What do you think, Seth?
This makes me think of I don't know why, the 95 NCAA tournament, where I think it was the third round, UCLA was playing Alabama.
This is an incredibly specific reference, and Alabama had Antonio McDice.
Yeah.
And like in the first four possessions of the game, Tyus Edney broke his guy down, got in the lane, got fouled by McDice.
Oh, that was the tournament. That was the tournament. Cameron Dollar won the national championship for UCLA.
Yeah.
95.
After
Tyus went down. Yeah.
Yeah. I was at the Final Four that year.
Yeah.
Seattle. But that was also the year where he went full court against Missouri
in like 3 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he basically, the game was over 3 minutes in because he got the two fouls on.
Yeah.
And this was when coaches would still
take him out right away.
Foul his own player, his own best player out.
Does that drive you crazy as an analyst, by the way? When coaches foul their players long before they're fouled out?
So they're situated. So Karl Anthony Towns picks up fouls, get him out because
he'll keep fouling, you think?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really good insight. The one that
boggles my mind is when like your backup four, who's going to play 13 minutes, comes in, picks up two fouls. You're like, oh, okay. So he fouls out. You don't have him.
So with you on that.
Great. Yeah. It's great if he fouls out. No problem at all.
It's like if they have a hard, fast rule, it makes no sense. Yeah.
So can we talk about 2-for-1 for a second? So, as a little background, at one of the early Sloan conferences, Daryl Morey goes in this little thing standing in the hallway about how, like, you know, most of what we're talking about, there isn't sufficient data to support like right or wrong answers. And I was like, well, what is there enough? And he said, well, 2-for-1, because at the end of every quarter, there's a scenario that we can see. End of every quarter of every game, playoffs, regular season, like I think 2-for-1, we really kind of know what the right thing is. And, you know, 12 years later or whatever it is now, you know, many teams are pretty studious about like getting that shot up
most
31 seconds left or whatever it is.
Most
not everyone, but most. And so this is like arguably a little flag for like, you know, the stats have influenced the game. And Seth, who were nominating as a referee of all such things, says that he thinks it's total bullshit, which is amazing.
I think it's overblown. Because there was Jeff Van Gundy was on the, or it might have been Daryl. No, it's Jeff Van Gundy who was on stage at Sloan and you know was asked, okay, fine, this is good. What's it? How much is it worth? I don't remember exactly what he said, but I think it was similar. I've kind of done the study and basically made some estimates about how often you could do it and some percentages about like what kind of shots you're going to get in various situations. It's worth maybe a win every 2 years, two wins every 3 years. So it's like, it's not nothing, but it's like,
it's not much.
Yeah.
You're saying two bad shots is not better than one good one.
It depends on how bad the bad shots are.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I want to hear. The qualifier. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like if the teams that used it well are the teams that, you know, it's Dame Lillard, it's Kyle Lowry, it's Steph Curry. These are players who could reliably just dribble down, get you a 32% three-pointer with 32 on the clock just every time. And it's you have an advantage. Now, what you end up doing is some teams end up coming down and taking like what is a theoretically like a 24% three-pointer or they do it too late on the clock or something like that. And then you're just completely. So if a coach decides, I don't think we can execute that. It would be good, better if you could, but I don't think they're giving much away if they're wrong and they could execute it. I don't think they're giving much away. And it's probably, again, back to time efficiency.
I think if you have Chris Paul, you want him to know this.
Yes.
Right. That's where it applies. Right.
Yeah.
And if you don't have Chris Paul, then sorry. You know,
well, tell Chris Paul, hey, if we get, we need to get a decent shot with 32 on the clock. And it's like, good. I got it from here.
Yeah. And then he's like flying at the rim and the defense is freaked out because Chris Paul, and then, you know, he's popping it out to some easy, you know, he's going to work it out in his brain so that it's very advantageous for your team. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I have one more question for Seth. I know, Henry, you've got something. I want to ask you this, Seth. So I don't think this is happening in the NBA, but I'm wondering if you think it ever could. And that is this. When I work with point guards, I have what I call the rule of four. And the rule of four simply is, if on three straight half-court possessions, if we take a bad shot, as determined by either me, the coach, or you, the point guard, it ain't happening a fourth time. We better run something that we trust can get us a good look. We're not score, but we're going to get a good look. And I want that to come from the analytics department. I want them to tell, just like we talked about the Looney Curry pick and roll is the most efficient two-man. I want someone to inform the point guard, here's our five best things you can run in this order in this particular game. And when we don't score three straight times in the half court, if we score, but it's a bullshit shot, a banker three, that doesn't count. Like we got to get because you start getting steamrolled. The other team starts getting real confidence and three misses becomes five, becomes six, becomes nine. And now you're down 18 to four and you're really in trouble. So give me your thoughts on that from the analytics side.
I like getting more responsibility, but this is a tough one because it's actually figuring out the essentially you're getting away from wanting to see because there aren't that many actions that we run a ton of times a year. So we ran this four times and scored 8 points. Okay, well, you mentioned banked in a three. I mean, you could have gotten terrible shots and they just happened to go in.
Right.
So you're really trying to which possession did we get good situations, good shots from? And that's a little harder because then you have to sort of define programmatically what you mean by an action. And that's even with the tracking data we have. You know, there's been a paper every year at Sloan just about where it's like, you know, play matching from tracking data.
Yeah.
And it's they're actually, to my eye, they're getting worse.
We're
getting further away from being able to do this.
What about targeting defenders as part of that? Mm-hmm. Like if they have a weak defender on the court, make sure on the fourth possession we're going after the weakest defender, which is something I say all the time to them.
I mean, I think if a team has a scheme that allows them to do that, like I remember a couple years ago in the playoffs, the Suns when they were playing the Nuggets, I believe, and they were like. You know, they weren't necessarily running actions to get Porter Jr.'s guy a shot, but they're looking to put him in a situation where he had to make a decision defensively. Yeah. And it would, you know, we know the key defender on this play is actually guarding the person who sets the wedge screen at the start or something like that. Oh, Porter Jr. That's where we're going to run and we get a dunk out of it. or something like that.
Yeah.
So I think there is something to that, but I think that the definitional aspect of it to be able to figure out, like, I think one the most powerful, you know, phrase in analytics is, I don't know. And this is sort of the ones like, what are our best actions? It's like, you know, I can maybe, okay, maybe when we run horn sets, we get good shot quality. But if you want to, if you want me to say, well, we get better stuff out of horns dive than horns twist. Like,
right. No, that's a little too specific. I hear you on that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
This is a slight change topic, but in your book, you mentioned casually, and we've talked about it on the show before, that it costs about $3 million for a regular season win in the NBA.
It's going up.
It's going up. Then there's a little footnote. So it does, like, you know, but the playoff win is like incalculable. And there's a footnote that says, like, actually, we could totally calculate that, but that's not what we're doing right now. But with Stephen Lardy on the show, we've kind of ruminated about how it is quite difficult to calculate because, well, anyway, it's difficult. The regular rules of regulation don't apply, but how would you go about that?
Wow. I mean, it's the, there's so many things you have to define, just like, what is the value you're putting on? Like, even relative to a regular season, like, how many what is the value relative to a regular season win of advancing from the first to second round of the playoffs? And how are you, so what are even the units we're talking about here? Are we talking, or are we just talking about championship equity? And for championship equity, like, we only care about four teams anyway, because the rest of them, it's nice. You made the second round and then you got, you know, windshielded by the team that ends up winning the title. So
windshielded, that's a terribly bad verb. You don't want to get windshielded like at all. Like, yeah. But, like, you know, so, like, when I pick your player, but, you know, get Gary Payton the second was super good in the playoffs, like, which is, does what to his market value compared to,
well, the problem is
that in the regular season, you know,
the fact that he's that he appears to be playable in the playoffs doesn't hurt. Mm-hmm. However, it's how much of that was situational, both his own situation. I think Golden State was mentioned about, Wiseman being a bad fit. Like, Gary, everyone in the league knows what Gary Payton the second can do, but the things he can't do held him back until he got to a situation where he didn't have to do the things. Like, he's a point guard size guy who can't really run an offense and isn't a great shooter, especially from the top of the floor. Okay, well, we'll play him like a small forward on offense and have him, because we've got ball handlers elsewhere, and have him, you know, dog point guards and
with some cameos as a five.
Yeah,
and the dunk spot.
Yeah, the Bruce Brown Memorial, like, right. Play this guy in a weird spot.
Yeah.
So there's his value was specific to that, but also who they're playing against. I mean, if they're, you know, how valuable is Gary Payton II if you're playing Philly? I mean, I guess now it would be, but pre Harden and when before Maxie kind of had emerged, when, like, Philly's offense was Joel Embiid, like, what's that for? Is he going to, you're going to stick him on, Shane Milton?
Right.
And that's going to swing the series.
Right. That's a great point.
So that's the problem with like playoff analysis. And a pet peeve of mine is after the first round, they're like, oh, they have the best defensive rating of any team in the playoffs. Well, yeah, they played the same team. Like, the reason you use rating is like it's like a measure of like what you've done against the whole league, like a reasonably good sample across the whole league. If my last year in Milwaukee, we played Detroit in the first round, and that was the year Blake was great. And then got hurt before the playoffs. So we beat them by about 133 points in four games. And so, yeah, well, like, the Bucks were the best team in the first round. They had a net rating of plus 93. It's like, yeah, but we played a team that was out on its feet. That dragged into the playoffs. What does that mean about anything compared to, you know, these other teams that have, you know, a 4-5 matchup where two pretty good teams have, how can you say we played better than either of those teams?
Right. Okay. So let's pretend that I'm an impetuous billionaire. And I've called you into my office because
that look about you.
I do. I feel that way. Let's say I just want a multiple, right? Like, stats in the playoffs are worth 1.5, 4, 8x, like, stats in the regular season. What's your?
I mean, what stats are we talking about? I mean, well, we're talking about counting stats. Who cares?
I'm an impetuous billionaire, Seth. Yeah. I don't have to answer that question. I just need you, like, basically, like a, you know, a bucket, whatever. Like, but if we had, so right now, I think that most stats programs count it as one. They're the same, right? That's probably wrong. What would no, be right?
I mean, I think most we mostly just like ignore the playoffs.
Yeah, or ignore or zero.
No, just wipe clean. Because it's, yeah. because it's such a because it's it it is a because of the you know playing the same team playing a, the with the different travel and it is a you know that they say the game changes in the playoffs. It's a different game, different players, different skills, and so we're not working with the same units of measurement. So it's like. That's a separate. Now, what we can say is that the value of the best players rises. And as you get sort of the top of the pyramid, this is, you know, I've done this research and really the person who turned me onto this was Kevin Pelton was, you know, you start to get like, you know, a guy who is the difference between the fifth best and 10th best player is just massively more than the difference between the 25th and 30th best player mm-hmm. in terms of how much champ, like put in terms of championship equity, in terms of championship equity they give you, because you get to that very top of the pyramid of like concentrated value in one player. And I, you know, there's a lot of theories as to why this could be, but it's demonstrable. And so that's, you know, you like, all right, do I want one? Do I want a dollar or four quarters in the playoffs? You want the dollar. Because the dollar is worth $1.50.
So, but the $3 million, we're starting with the $3 million per win number, which comes from pretty simple math, right? Like, right.
We know how much the league spends. We know right. there's 1,230 wins out there.
Right.
Yeah.
But we forgot the playoffs. Like, what yeah. if we unforgot the playoffs, right? What if we stuck them in there? Like, you know,
well, we can
carve it up in some fashion. No.
So I get credit for, so Gary Payton gets credit for being standing next to Steph Curry. So he was, you know, he was there to play in four playoff rounds.
Well, I mean, you know, this is the thing you could say about all of plus minus stats, right? Like, but, yeah. you know, so we have a small sample size problem. We do.
But our techniques with the plus minus stats attempt to control for that.
Right.
And they do a decent job of that. But in terms of how far your team advances, that is, you know, especially for role players, you have some impact on that, but that's like, am I playing next to Steph Curry or Bradley Beal as the best player?
Right. So of course, acknowledged, you know, these will not be good numbers, like, you know, bettable numbers, but like, you know, nevertheless, we have to make these kinds of calls, like with these crappy inputs, people still have to build their rosters. Right. So as they do so, would you, and you know, I'll drop it now, but like, you know, do you feel like it's roughly, you know, unusable playoff stats, or do you feel like someone performing well in the playoffs is worth a little more than playing well in the regular season?
I think this is one of those ones where, like, I could give you a number, but you're kind of asking me to lie to you. I would much rather say, you know, this. Okay, here are some skill sets that tend to translate to the playoffs, and here are like, you know,
okay,
you know, I wrote about this in the book, but like, kind of the below the rim interior big is a skill set that, you know, you can play some bully ball in the regular season, doesn't work in the playoffs. So, okay, maybe that, but you know, on the flip side, you can never have enough athletic, versatile 6'6" guys.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's no situation where, oh man, it's too bad we have that fifth good wing. No one said no one ever in the playoffs.
That's why Masai hasn't traded any of his guys.
Yeah.
Those wings, but it's still situational. Steven Adams was huge in the Warriors series when it made them go bigger. Kevon Looney is the classic undersized, not even so big. So that's why you're saying it's situational. Excuse it, but I have to make a suggestion to you, Seth. I have very, very few good ideas as to what the average person would want to read, but I know I want to read a Seth Partnow column or podcast where you tell us your pet peeves. That would be fascinating.
Yeah.
I am down for that. Mm-hmm. Tell whomever. I am down for that.
We are approaching Festivus. So.
Yes. Let's go.
I got a lot of problem with you people.
Right. Let's go. As soon as you go to Seinfeld route, I'm in. I was already in.
There's a fun little detour in your book, The Midrange Theory, where who would win? Someone asked you in your job, who would win a game of five centers versus five point guards? And It did hurt my head a little bit just to even think about it, but I thought maybe you and David would want to discuss that now.
Well, who are the centers and point guards?
No, it's just, you know, average center, average point guard, five of them against five of them. Like, it was sort of because, you know, there's a lot of situations in basketball we'd like to analyze, but because people have over, you know, 100 years of basketball, have gotten pretty smart about things, we kind of don't have the comparison of the really dumb things to look at. Like the big place where this is coming up now is this is something that Daryl Morey's talked about a lot. And I think we're seeing it this year. Offensive rebound rate is way up. Mm-hmm. And this is something like certainly with the tracking data, you can start to identify places where actually we can be aggressive there and not compromise our transition defense. Right. However, that analysis is made difficult by the fact that for the most part, NBA players are pretty smart and they don't crash the boards really stupidly. So there's not a comparison of, well, if I, like, we know, okay, I'm the, we're playing like a 1-4 low. Someone shoots from the corner. I'm the point guard at the top. I think we know that I can't crash the offensive boards there. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, I remember Zach LaVine doing it once when he was a rookie. But other than that, it's like not something that happens.
There was this one time.
Yeah. It had to be Zach LaVine.
It's not something that happens. So we don't, like, we can't, like, measure the trade-off there because the thing that seems obviously dumb just never happens. Mm-hmm. And so it's similar way, like, what would five centers look like? No one has come close. I mean, maybe like the closest was probably like the Nuggets in the bubble when someone was out and they were just like starting like Bol Bol and Jokic and Plumlee. And this was in like the regular season games, which is the closest I can remember it coming. Maybe like the Magic played some just enormous line, but even then, those aren't like five centers.
No,
like,
Milwaukee's gone Giannis, Portis, and Lopez this year.
Yeah.
Yeah. And listen, Seth, you're preaching to the choir, buddy, because at True Hoop, we've been pushing this idea of teams going bigger, not smaller, playing two centers at the same time, like McGee and Ayton last year for Phoenix and a few others. But all of your fancy words are meant to disorient dumb ball coaches like me. What's your answer? Because I know what I'm saying.
My intuition is the point guards.
Me too, man. I'm all in on the point guards.
Yeah. Listen, yeah. Jose Alvarado would have 8,000 steals against any big man you choose that's average. Giannis is different, right? There's some tall guys that he wouldn't. But those guys can't get the ball past half court against those little quick dudes. And they can shoot threes. It's not even close. They'll get beat up on the glass for sure. But you can fight. Like a big, you just face guard. As much as you can. You
block guys out. Plus, little guys are allowed a lot of liberties with big guys.
That is true. As someone who's coached a lot of big men, it pisses me off.
Like Jeff Van Gundy hanging off Alonzo Mourning's leg.
Right.
Yeah.
Big men do get punished.
So let me ask you something. This is something that's come up. We've seen a lot of, I think, pretty questionable offensive and especially flagrant fouls called where defenders are basically drawing fouls with their face. And I was kind of always taught growing up that you stick your face there,
you break your jaw. Yeah,
exactly. The coach is like, you come in there, you get your jaw broke.
That's right.
It's what coach said to me. Is there something we can do to like, that should frankly, yeah, you get hit in the face, but you fouled him with your face.
Right.
Instead of it being like a natural basketball move.
But isn't that the key though, Seth? Isn't it supposed to be if I'm just naturally going up to I'm doing this on video as if anyone's seeing it. It's a defensive foul. But if I put my elbow out, my arms out away from, you know, the general construct of my body, well, that's on the offense. I thought I could ask a referee that in the NBA. That's what I thought it was supposed to be. You're right. It happens. We still aren't great at not punishing the defense when the offense clearly initiates contact. And I teach this. So we're taking advantage of these referees that keep giving us the benefit of the doubt on that. But a defensive guy is sliding, and you throw your elbow or shoulder into me. That should not be a foul on me. Even though I'm not set, I had my space. You invaded my space. That's a foul on you or no call. And especially if you're a superstar.
It shouldn't be a foul on me because I'm 6 inches taller and I turn and shoot. And
right.
And like, right. Because you're like, I'm gesturing, but because your face is like
at the center of my chest. In my space,
yeah.
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 Like, all of, like, my elbow goes, like,
yeah.
What's your face doing there?
Right.
I think we're in a temporary reactionary, maybe dumb phase, but, like, there was, you know, when the concussion thing came to the NFL, the NBA hired this guy from the University of Michigan, I think he was, and he enacted a whole protocol of, like, here's how we're going to handle concussions, and they just frankly blatantly don't do it. Like, they don't follow the protocol. It's supposed to be every time anyone gets significantly hit in the head, they're taken back to the locker room for baseline concussion protocol testing. And, like, that's what the lawyer said they would do. That's what they said they would do. And they fucking don't. They didn't do it for 5 minutes. Like, and so we're in this thing where I think that their preferred solution is everyone's very careful not to hit LeBron in the head. And so they want defenders to be extra careful with those elbows. And honestly,
But if LeBron, like, hits Isaiah Stewart in the face and
nobody cares.
That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's not be ridiculous.
That was a night. If people don't remember, like, he was, you know, had blood pouring down his face and he wanted to get at LeBron.
Oh, yeah.
Isaiah Stewart ran into the tunnel on the opposite side to go around the referees to go after LeBron.
Yeah.
He was a little cranky. Yeah. When this all started, I watched a season's worth of LeBron and Dwayne Wade attacking the rim. And, like, if Marcus Camby was the big man, he absolutely had a strategy of hitting them in the head. Like, he would ring their, and, like, if you, and if you could see it, like, if you hit LeBron in the head really hard, which happened a lot, his next drive would, instead of being like 3 minutes away, would be 7 minutes away. Like, it was a real strategy around the NBA, and they think they're trying to unwind that, right? It was effective. So I think we're in this, like, temporary thing of, if anybody gets hit in the head, someone's getting a flagrant. And so that everybody learns not to do it. And it's stupid at times, as you're finding, right? I think it's stupid at times. I don't know what the right answer is, but they just want, like, the just, notion, you know, that the you right just get your bell wrong.
Say it is.
Okay, there you go.
They should intuit that and just do that. I don't know.
We did invite you as the authority. That is the basis of your being on the show. So
the wizard has spoken. Oz has spoken.
All right. We have used quite a lot of time. Seth, do you have any parting thoughts? Do you have any awards to hang out for any? Like, actually, we should recap just out of measure. Did the Nets win that game? I don't remember. Did they beat the Mavs?
No.
Oh.
And we end with some results oriented thinking. You want to talk about pet peeves? Results oriented thinking.
I love that.
Winning was a good shot.
There's a book. Yeah. Our podcast, there's something there, my man. I'd love to see your pet peeves.
Yeah. Seth's had enough of blank.
Right. Yeah, it's a really good title right there. I've had enough.
Yeah. Now you're asking me to name names, and that's dodgy.
Well, you can.
Only if you want to get back in the league. Yeah. Otherwise, just let it rip, you know?
Right.
All right.
You're right. Festus is here. You owe it to us. If you're not, if you don't do it, that's the grievance that I'm airing.
Okay. Airing of the grievances. Yep.
Yeah. It's a safe place for grievances here. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Seth.
Thanks, Seth.
Thank you, David. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Gerard, who was sort of on the show.
Well, Henry froze. But thank you, guys, and happy Thanksgiving to all. We'll see you next week.